You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wai Wharahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. Coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the party stance on the Paris Agreement. And I also speak to Dr. Maria Armudian, an Associate Professor in Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland, the Director of the University Sustainability Hub, and the Co-Director of Ngā Ara Whatu Centre for Climate, Biodiversity and Society at the University, about the ACT Party stance on the Paris Agreement and the importance of the framework. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to the University of Auckland's Dr. Stephanie D'Souza about a study she co-authored showing that high-level rugby players faced an increased risk of Alzheimer's and other dementias at later ages.
Here are Hofakaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text in on 5395, or why am I rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware, e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei a pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te apai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text 5395 or call 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
Time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Recently, ACT Party leader David Seymour announced the party's position statement on climate, saying that if the Paris Agreement isn't reformed, the country should leave the agreement. The Paris Agreement, signed by New Zealand by the then National Led government in 2016, aims to keep the global average temperature rise to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, with an overall aim of keeping the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Currently, Aotearoa is one of 195 UN parties to adopt this framework. If the country were to leave the Paris Agreement, the country would join the likes of the US, who signed an executive order to withdraw this year, and Iran, Libya and Yemen, who have never formally joined the statement. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, I spoke to him about the Paris Agreement and our future with this framework. Why is the party wanting to turn away from this agreement if these reforms aren't made?
Well, the Paris Climate Agreement demands targets that are disconnected from science and that are blind to New Zealand's realities. The net zero targets have been set without direct reference to the cost to firms, farms and families. And the result is that farmers have been forced off the land. Our regions are hollowing out as industries close. And we're paying higher prices for food and electricity and everything that we produce. And what ACT says is that we should remain engaged with our trading partners, but only on terms that make sense to us. And that means we must push for fundamental reforms of the Paris framework so that New Zealand can actually get a better deal than the one that Labor and the Greens offered when they sent James Shaw to Glasgow saying we're going to reduce our emissions by 50% by 2030. Not only is it not achievable, if New Zealand was to try and achieve it, it would be very, very expensive. It's estimated that potentially the downside risk of us staying in Paris and failing to achieve the target is in the tens of billions of dollars. And no one's going to pay that, so we have to renegotiate.
Speaking more to those reforms of the framework, there has been some concern over the lack of transparency regarding what changes the party wants to see to the Paris Agreement. What specific reforms would the ACT party like to see here?
Well, certainly the ability to renegotiate a nationally determined contribution. That's when you send a minister off, say, to Paris or Glasgow or one of these other conferences and tell the world, essentially tell the UN what your country is going to do. Look, if it turns out that that was not the right target for your country, we need to be able to renegotiate that target. As I pointed out, the target that James Shaw took off to Glasgow was unachievable, it was reckless, and it has committed New Zealand either to taking action that destroys industries and keeps families in the dark and cold because of high electricity prices, or apparently someone's going to be sending a cheque off to the UN for tens of billions of dollars from New Zealand. None of those things are going to happen. So we have to be able to renegotiate our nationally determined contribution in line with what works for New Zealand.
This is a pretty big ask, right? Especially from a party that received 8% of the total vote in the 2023 general election in a small country such as New Zealand. How likely is it even that the UN would reform the agreement, especially without the help of national nor the opposition parties who are more in favour of staying a part of this agreement?
Well, that's a choice for New Zealand to make. We can ask, we can ask the UN, you can write them a letter, you can negotiate with them, you say, look, this needs to change for us. But ACT points out, if the Paris Agreement can't change, New Zealand can't stay in it, because what we've seen is with the flow-on effects from the carbon price to our electricity prices, from the threats to farming in New Zealand, from high carbon prices leading to carbon forestry. You know, pine trees that no one can eat, replacing animals and crops. This does not work for New Zealand. So, you know, what ACT is saying, and we think it's a very reasonable position, is if those who hold the pen and hold the scrolls at the UN can't accept that New Zealand needs to adopt a different target that's practical and achievable, then we'll have to leave. And that just simply involves writing a letter to the UN and giving them notice. That's an entirely reasonable position for New Zealand to take.
You mentioned that ACT would want to remain engaged with trading partners if we left this agreement. Is the party concerned that if we were to leave this agreement, that this may impact our relationships with countries who abide by the agreement?
Well, there are countries and then there are customers. And if you think about who are New Zealand's customers, those are consumers in places like Europe and Asia and the US who want to buy New Zealand products. And when you dig a bit deeper below these so-called free trade agreements, what you find is actually the big producers of, say, dairy products in New Zealand and other food have supplier-to-customer arrangements with big customers in Europe. And so what they will tell you is, look, as long as we are doing our bit on-farm to meet our emissions targets, to keep our customers happy, it doesn't really matter what international agreements you have between the countries. So I think we need to be realistic. New Zealand sells great food to the world. Consumers around the world are going to want to continue buying it, no matter what grandstanding or virtue signalling their governments might do around climate change.
You've mentioned customers and consumers quite a bit there. Prime Minister Christopher Luxon makes an interesting point that leaving the Paris Agreement would actually harm rural communities more over New Zealand's competitive advantage regarding our sustainability credentials in the global market. What do you make of this claim? Will this impact our rural communities?
Well, that's what I said. We need to look at the next level of detail, because New Zealand businesses that manufacture food here and sell it to the world have direct relationships with their customers, with very large customers in places like Europe and the US and Asia. And what those customers are saying is that if New Zealand if New Zealand suppliers can meet their climate emissions targets, or mitigation targets, then it doesn't really matter what the New Zealand government This is about supplier to customer relationships first. And I think we just need to be clear that New Zealand's not going to go backwards when it comes to the environment and sustainability. We're going to keep improving, but what we're not going to do is sign up to targets that force the carbon price up so that Kiwis are struggling to pay bills or put food on the table because, you know, carbon forestry is replacing growing food. That's just not sustainable for New Zealand.
In 2023, we saw the Auckland floods and especially Cyclone Gabrielle heavily impact rural landscapes in the country. With what ACT are proposing here, how will the party guarantee that we can still keep on track with mitigating the impacts of the climate crisis and working towards sustainability?
Well, you raise a good point. And there is no direct link between any action that New Zealand might take to reduce its carbon or other emissions and the climate. And so that is where science and reality have become divorced from rhetoric and virtue signalling. There is no better case for New Zealand to reassess our commitment to the Paris Accord than to have floods and cyclones thrown at us on the nightly news and say, look, if we don't do more to stop driving cars and farm less, look, your climate's going to burn. It's absolute rubbish. New Zealanders know it's rubbish. And the fact that people keep pointing to these things as the reason to reduce climate emissions, I think the emperor finally has no clothes.
I just want to reiterate that last part of the question there. How will the party guarantee that we can still keep on track with mitigating the impacts of the climate crisis and working towards sustainability?
Well, New Zealand's share of global emissions is about 0.18%. So even if we reduced our emissions to zero, the rest of the world that, you know, like we think about Russia, China, India, the US and Europe, you know, their emissions would overtake what New Zealand might cut in a matter of days or weeks. So there is no reason for us to impoverish ourselves. There's nothing that we can do to affect the climate from here in little old New Zealand by making ourselves poorer and cutting our emissions. We need to do what's right for New Zealanders, and that's what ACT is asking. And if people want to find out more about it, they should go to our website, which is changeorleave.nz, find out more, and sign up to the petition that we're running to gather support for this policy position.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the party's stance on the Paris Agreement.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Wallau Radio. 2 hours of music from Southeast Asia and its diaspora. Complete with spicy takes, close inspections, interviews, and everything in between.
Wallau Radio. Monday nights, 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. Brought to you by your hosts, Otto and JC. Only on 95 BFM.
Wallawi!
All My Friends by LCD Sound System, and before that was Gorillaz by Oh No No. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire here on 95 BFM.
Well, first of all, oh, I love it. I've clearly given up on trying to have any sort of neutrality in this interview.
The Wire.
Following on from my chat with MP Simon Court, I spoke to Dr. Maria Armudian, an associate professor in politics and international relations at the University of Auckland, the director of the University Sustainability Hub, and the co-director of the Ngā Ara Whatu Centre for Climate, Biodiversity and Society at the University, on the ACT Party stance on the Paris Agreement. ACT's stance on the Paris Agreement has received substantial criticism, despite New Zealand First also being in support of moving away from the Paris Agreement. National have been staunch on continuing with this framework alongside the opposition parties. Greenpeace campaigner Amanda Larson has referred to ACT Party leader David Seymour's comments regarding the framework as rage-baiting the extremist edge of the farming community to grab headlines, and that Prime Minister Christopher Luxon mustn't bite. This comes as Luxon indicated last week changes to our methane targets. Methane makes up almost a third of global warming and is over 80 times more powerful than CO2 in the short term. I spoke to Armudian about this, starting with how important the Paris Agreement is and what exactly the framework is. How important is the Paris Agreement and what is the Paris Agreement?
So just as a start, let's just start with the Paris Agreement's importance. Look, I think our planet is in heaps of trouble. Climate scientists have now gone back and recalculated the kind of trouble we're in, and they said now we are on track to exceed that 1.5 degrees Celsius level above pre-industrial levels in 3 years. So that's 2028, not 2030. So the Paris Agreement developed because of the science showing us that we were going to be in heaps of trouble if we didn't start to reduce our emissions and reduce the temperature of the climate. And so we don't cook the whole planet, so we don't burn it, right? So it's a binding legal treaty that came into force in November of 2016. And the signatories, which included every country with the exception of three, which was, I think, Iran, Libya, and maybe Syria. I'll double check that. Oh, no, Yemen. I think even Syria was on there. So they agreed to take action to limit the planetary temperatures to that 1.5 and to try even 2 degrees, right? So why 1.5? That's the point at which climate scientists have said we're going to be facing really more catastrophic impacts. And so that's the importance of the agreement. Now, since the agreement was signed, and like I said, all countries except for Iran, Libya, and Yemen had signed on to it, even though I believe they even endorsed it, even though they didn't agree to do it. Only the United States has withdrawn. And only the United States under Donald Trump, which means that he withdrew toward the end of his first term, and then Joe Biden re-entered the Paris Agreement, and then Donald Trump came in and pulled out one more time. So if we were to pull out of the agreement, we would be in the company of Iran, Libya, Yemen, and Donald Trump. And that's not a very good look. Now, not only is it not a very good look and makes us a rogue nation among other rogue nations, but it's really bad diplomatically to make a commitment and then say, oh, just kidding. It makes us look unreliable. It makes us look untrustworthy. And it makes us look like bad neighbors, especially to our Pacific community. And so it leaves a big diplomatic hole for others to step in. That might be China. We don't know who steps in into the void if New Zealand fails to be a good neighbor and fails to be trustworthy. And I'll tell you one thing about small countries. You know, we don't have huge military prowess to offer the rest of the world. And we don't have huge economic benefits to offer the rest of the world. What small countries have to offer is a different kind of diplomacy. It's called soft power. And soft power is all about these things like trust and good neighbor and good policy and, you know, kind of that idea that we're reliable and we're helping the world rather than being part of the problem, being part of the solution, even leading in the solution.
If we were to leave the framework, would we still be bound to meeting climate targets in any capacity in international law?
You know, that's a very good question, and I am not 100% sure I could answer that without a lawyer next to me. But I would think that, you know, there may be some consequences, but I, you know, because it was a binding treaty that we signed on to, but I can't remember what the exit strategies were in the thing.
Although the National Party have not indicated plans to leave this agreement, how much power does ACT have here, especially maybe with the support of New Zealand First, who are also in favour of leaving this agreement?
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it, the politics here. So I think a few things we have to acknowledge. One is that it is a coalition government, and so these two parties do have considerable power in sort of negotiating with National Party, because without those two parties, the coalition could fall apart. And so there is some power to try to push the National Party into that direction. However, we have seen some other attempts by ACT to push the National Party into a particular direction, particularly with the treaty principles. And we saw that it was really kind of not just a failure for ACT to get it through, but it was kind of for show, you know. It seemed like it was just kind of shock and awe of the country in a way. And this could be something like that too. I mean, look, one thing is for sure, Donald Trump has shown politicians how to be outlandish, and by being outlandish, they get a lot of attention in the media. And those of us who've been in the media know that, you know, that kind of sensationalism really, it, you know, pricks our attention. And so we go, oh my God, what's going on? And then we have to cover it. So it keeps them in the eyes of everybody. But then the problem is that their framing can be contagious, and that people can start to lose the overall view by seeing the narrow view that they're putting forward.
How would our trading partners view our sort of clean green image if we were to leave this agreement?
Oh, that's a great question. Look, New Zealand is in big trouble in terms of our green, clean image already. I mean, I'm just going to talk about the animal issue right now. We've got more than 4,000 native species that are either threatened or at risk of extinction. And that's an old number. It's probably much worse now. So that's 90% of seabirds, 80% of shorebirds, 26% of native marine mammals, and about, what do we have, 55 Maui dolphins left over the age of 1 year, something like that. The numbers may have changed since 2022. I can't imagine they've gotten much better. So why is that happening? Well, it's a number of things, and climate is part of it. So when the climate warms, and it's just like, for example, for the birds, the climate warms and some animals that need cooler temperatures start to move. So some fish may start to move. Some other animals may migrate to cooler temperatures. What happens when the birds need to get food? They have to go farther and farther and farther, and it's difficult. So these are just examples. So not all of this, you know, threatening of the biodiversity is a result of climate change, but it's a major factor. So this is just one problem that we're going to be facing. And, you know, I think people do look to New Zealand to see the beautiful native fauna and the beautiful native flora, and to think about what it is to be a great eco-haven for these places. And we've done such great things with individual species, and we show the world that, but then we forget to acknowledge all the others that are in decline as a result. So it's not very good.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Maria Amudian on ACT's stances on the Paris Agreement and the importance of maintaining the country's commitments to this framework.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Astonishing. Sublime.
as for my overtures and my painted on two-dimensional scenery and my taste for vaudevillian delivery. The way you turn your chest on me, I'm embarrassed to be clever when you're honest. You make me want to be ready. I feel different now than I did before. I can see how my power only was my fear of betrayal. In your eyes, I'm naked, screaming like a tornado in the dark. I can see us lying face to face as St. Helens is underneath the stars. And I notice you are gentle. By the way, your posture is so elegant. And I notice you are noble, you are kind, or at least entertained by your time sitting here with me. Okay, I'll share this. When I was 5, I remember clearly my want to have a Cinderella birthday party. And when the moment came and I changed my mind, I was quiet, alone, and devastated. You make me want to be ready. I feel different now than I did before. I can see all my power only was my fear of betrayal. In your eyes, I am naked, screaming like a tornado in the dark. I can see us laying face to face as St. Helens is underneath the stars. Just know I've cleared the way. Just know I won't leave as I came. Just know I'll keep the mirror you gave. Just know I won't leave as I came. I won't leave as I came. Have stayed.
your heart doesn't mean I'm erased. And if I say I know, would it be a mistake? I was once away, and now I
That was 100 Horses by Geese, Memory Box by Peter Cat Recording Co., and before that was Cinderella by Model Actress. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
You know, alcohol is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay, it's BFM.
The Wire. Last week, a study was published in the Sports Medicine Journal revealing that over an extended period, male high-level rugby players were more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease or other neurodegenerative diseases than the general population. This comes as increasing research and attention is being paid to head trauma and the way it affects the individual in the long term. I spoke to Dr. Stephanie D'Souza, co-author of the study and senior lecturer at the University of Auckland, about the study's results, what they tell us about head and brain injuries, and what that means for New Zealand's national sport. To get us started, what exactly are we seeing in this study?
So with this particular study, we had a group of about 13,000, almost 13,000 high-level rugby players. These were players that were playing at provincial or above, between 1950 to 2000, and we compared them to almost 2.4 million men from the general population. And what we found was a 22% increased risk of neurodegenerative diseases from clinical diagnoses. And this was particularly specific to Alzheimer's and other dementias in terms of long-term risk. And we do see this actually increased risk start to appear around age 70 onwards.
And what makes these neurodegenerative diseases in particular so concerning?
Great question. They can have quite a significant impact, obviously, on your long-term well-being. These are diseases that are linked to memory loss, loss of other functions. They can be quite significant in the way that they affect the people that are impacted, and eventually lead to the point of requiring, you know, significant care as well. So they have impact for the individual affected as well as their family members, and so making sure that there are ways to mitigate risk as much as possible and understand the what can lead to this risk is really important.
And in terms of public health outcomes, how significant is this increased risk in the wider scale of the New Zealand health system?
So in terms of understanding this, I guess, practically, like with the population that we looked at, say with the general population, if we took a 1,000 men, 52 of those men would develop a neurodegenerative disease. With the group that played rugby, we had 13 extra cases that developed this. So we are seeing this, you know, increased risk. It does indicate that the sporting organisations that are addressing that, you know, do need to be mindful that it exists, make sure that there are strategies to mitigate this risk from, you know, trying to reduce it as much as possible, and make sure that there's education as well for those affected, such as players.
And what about rugby and the nature of head injuries, does this study tell us?
So with these sort of collision sports, things like rugby, also other sports like American football, these associations between participating in the sport and later neurodegenerative disease risks, what is thought to underlie it is the number of head impacts that the individual has over their career. So it's, you know, cumulative head impacts, essentially. What we see, interestingly, with our study is that backline players have a greater risk of these later neurodegenerative diseases than the forwards, which is kind of unexpected given this hypothesis that I just mentioned, because forwards are the ones that are typically involved in more collision events and so would be exposed to more head impacts. Backs, however, tend to be faster and more agile players. So what our results seem to suggest is maybe it's not just the number of head impacts, but also the nature of the head impacts that could be contributing to increased risk as well. So faster, high-velocity impacts could also be a risk factor.
And what sort of concerns, given the popularity of rugby in Aotearoa, kind of exist about how frequently this is happening?
Yeah, great question. This is a very kind of emerging research space when it comes to rugby union. There's not actually a lot of research of this nature where we've got these sort of large cohorts and representative of the time, you know, of players at the time that we're looking at. This is the largest study that's been done. There's only been one other study that's looked at rugby union. But given how popular rugby is for New Zealand, it's such a, you know, so ingrained in the culture, it does kind of highlight that there is potentially some, you know, long-term risk that we need to be mindful of. It is something that we need to make sure that we're mitigating injuries and head impacts particularly. We don't know kind of the extent. What we're looking at here is players, as I mentioned, that were active from 1950 to 2000. So we don't know what this would extend to with more recent cohorts as well. And since the sport was professionalised, so the sport was only professionalised around from 1995 towards the end of when our players were active. So there could be differences in how what risk is looking like with more contemporary players. But it's also important to highlight with the sporting organisations, they've also gotten better at managing that. So, you know, it's just an ongoing space that we need to be continuing to look into and understanding risk. But in the meantime, it's really important to try to make sure that we're mitigating risk as much as possible, educating players. I think trying to stop people from playing rugby is going to be very hard given our culture in New Zealand, but it is something that we need to be mindful of and trying to address and educate and minimise as much as possible.
You mentioned it there, but in terms of kind of what kind of research we have, and in particular what research we don't have, where do you kind of want to see this going, and where does the study fit?
So I did mention, we're not looking at more contemporary players. Just simply, firstly, that a lot of the players are not at an age yet where I guess they would have developed this. This is an older age condition. But one thing that we weren't able to do with our study was also look at women. It was just male players. And understanding what the risk is like for women is really important as well, particularly as we're seeing more and more women get into the sport. And there is some evidence that women may be more at risk of concussion and have a longer recovery from concussion, female athletes specifically. So understanding what that is, say, not just for men, but for women, but also being able to, with our study, we are looking at an association, but we weren't able to get any sort of measure of, say, the number of head impacts the players had in their career and what, you know, understanding what that might look like in terms of the mechanism. So if we're able to get information like, the number of head impacts they had, concussion events, stand down periods, etc., to understand exactly what is underlying this association, that would be really valuable as well.
And with all that in mind, what do you want to see from across the sport from organisations like NZ Rugby or local sports bodies and clubs?
I know that New Zealand Rugby have certain protocols that they use and there's been changes that have been made. I think it's continuing to make sure those are fit for purpose for all players. This will be probably better addressed at the higher level of the sport, but it's important that even at more community level and non-professional levels, that there are strategies in place to make sure that players are who are suspected of having a concussion are being proactively managed. Stand down periods following a concussion are you know enforced and adhered to, and that this sort of information is and research is ongoing and contributing to you know player understanding and education so that they're informed of the risks and benefits of the sport long term.
That was the University of Auckland's Stephanie D'Souza on rugby's impact on Alzheimer's risk.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
ko I ra te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kurudo mai ki maua mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party's Simon Court and the University of Auckland's Dr. Maria Armudian and Dr. Stephanie D'Souza. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.